It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Enbridge Energy's Line 5 pipeline. It starts in Superior. It moves hundreds of thousands of gallons of oil and natural gas a day. We get up to speed as Michigan regulators approve a tunnel project under the Straits of Mackinac to house the aging pipeline. Call in with a question. Share comments. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Danielle Kading is a WPR reporter covering the environment, energy, and northern Wisconsin based in the Superior Bureau. Danny, welcome back.
Thanks for having me on, Kate.
So a Michigan judge approves construction of this tunnel underneath the Straits of Mackinac for Line 5 pipeline. What would this tunnel do?
Yeah, so this is a $500 million tunnel, and it would be installed below the lake bed and encase Enbridge's oil pipeline, which currently splits into twin lines that run under the Straits of Mackinac. And so, you know, this is a 70-year-old pipe that is able to carry up to 23 million gallons of oil and natural gas liquids per day from Superior to Ontario through the Straits. And it currently lies on the bottom of the lake bed, and environmental advocates, tribes, and Michigan leaders are really concerned about the potential for a spill because there have been gaps in the pipe's protective coating, and there was also an anchor strike that happened that dented the line 5 years ago. And so for Enbridge, this tunnel would address those concerns and allow them to continue business as usual.
Meanwhile, the Bay Mills Indian community in Michigan and the Bad River Band of Lake Superior Chippewa in Wisconsin, they've been involved in litigation with Enbridge. How similar are the tribes' concerns?
Well, they're pretty similar in that they're rooted in this dispute over protection of their treaty rights. If you remember back in the 1800s, these tribes signed treaties with the federal government where they basically ceded millions of acres of land and water. And in exchange for that, the government promised these tribes that they would be able to maintain their rights to hunt, fish, and gather in these territories. And so in Michigan's legal challenge, Bay Mills has said that the Straits of Mackinac are some of the most productive waters for their tribal fishers. And in Bad River's lawsuit, they've argued that the pipeline threatens wetlands that support wild rice or manomin, which is a staple food and central to the tribe's migration story. And they also support a wide variety of species and plants that the tribe subsists on. And so both also argue that easement agreements for the pipeline have either expired or been revoked. And plus they highlight the company's environmental track record is a reason the pipe should be shut down or removed altogether, because Enbridge has been responsible for some of the largest oil spills on land across the country.
You know, Enbridge insists, though, that the pipeline is safe. How is it supporting that view in courtrooms and in regulatory reviews?
Well, related to Line 5 and the Straits, the company has said that there's never been an oil spill in the Great Lakes, and Enbridge also says there's never been a spill on the Bad River Reservation, although records have shown the pipe has had about 30 spills on land since the late 60s, I believe. But the company argues the pipeline is much safer than other methods of transportation, like truck or rail, and they say they have measures in place to detect any issues with the pipeline before a spill could occur, like inline inspections, video monitoring, and other technologies. And they're proposing new segments of the pipeline to replace these aging stretches on the Bad River Reservation and under the Straits of Mackinac. And with the tunnel in particular, they say it would be lined with reinforced concrete, and that would reduce the threat of an anchor strike or a spill. But the debate over what Enbridge is proposing and what tribes and environmental advocates want to see is still playing out as agencies like the Army Corps of Engineers, the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources, and federal courts review these projects.
There is a lot to watch here. Danny, thank you so much for joining us. Thanks for your reporting.
Yeah, thank you for having me on.
Danielle Kading is a WPR reporter based at the Superior Bureau. And now we hear from opponents of the Line 5 pipeline. And you can be part of the conversation, ask a question, share comments at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Beth Wallace is Great Lakes Freshwater Campaign's manager for the National Wildlife Federation. Beth, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me on. It's great to be here this morning.
And we also have Christopher Clark, senior attorney for Earth Justice, representing the Bay Mills Indian community in litigation against Enbridge. Christopher, welcome back.
Thank you for having me.
Christopher, starting with you, getting us up to speed on the Earth Justice opposition to the Line 5 pipeline. Explain where Earth Justice is at with this opposition.
So Earth Justice, in conjunction with the Native American Rights Fund, represents the Bay Mills Indian community in its advocacy regarding the Line 5 pipeline. And specifically, we have represented the tribe before the Michigan Public Service Commission and have presented arguments and evidence to that commission as to why the tunnel project that was being discussed a couple of minutes ago should not be approved.
I want to also, you've been working on this project for a long time on this litigation. There is multiple pieces of this litigation, multiple permits in a project like this. Can you kind of explain where are we at in the process?
Well, last week, unfortunately, the Michigan Public Service Commission issued a permit for Enbridge to construct the tunnel that's being constructed. But I think it's important to remember that all of this advocacy is really about protecting the Great Lakes and the water that is so valued and treasured. And as was done at the beginning of the segment, this is a very dangerous situation where they're not only in the Straits of Mackinac, where there's a significant concern about a potential leak in the Straits, but this is an aging pipeline across hundreds of miles that has leaked and spilled oil many, many times. This is literally a disaster waiting to happen. And one thing that we shouldn't forget is that this company, Enbridge, is responsible for the largest inland oil spill in the nation's history, which occurred in 2010 in Kalamazoo, Michigan. So all of the advocacy is centered on trying to get this pipeline out of the waters of the Great Lakes and to prevent the threat. There's litigation that's proceeding both in Michigan and Wisconsin to do just that. And we are representing the Bay Mills community in a variety of different fora in order to accomplish that objective.
Beth Wallace, from the perspective of the National Wildlife Federation, can you explain your opposition?
Yeah, actually, I grew up in the community that was devastated by the 2010 spill. My family and my friends all are still there. And when that spill happened, I became a watchdog over that response, but I also became very aware of the failures of our regulatory systems that led to that disaster and allowed Enbridge to have such a horrible response. And it forced us to look around to see where else there are risks. And since that time, we've raised alarm bells on Line 5. It's 15 years older than the one that ruptured in 2010. They increased pressure on it with minimal testing about 10 years ago. It truly is, at this point, America's most dangerous pipeline, and nobody disputes the fact that we need to get it out of the water. What is being disputed is how we do that, and unfortunately, a lot of the information that's come to bear from Enbridge's side is now misinformation. We fully understand that we can transition away from this pipeline. There's been multiple experts, including Enbridge's own expert, was forced to admit that an immediate closure of this pipeline would only result in 0.5 cent increase at the pump. We really need to sit back and have a logical conversation about the risk that we are all bearing for the private profit of this Canadian oil company.
Beth Wallace is Great Lakes Freshwater Campaigns Manager at the National Wildlife Federation. Christopher Clark is Senior Attorney with Earth Justice, representing Bay Mills Indian Community and Bad River Band of Lake Superior Chippewa. Be part of the discussion. Call in with a question. Add your thoughts at 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is the morning show. I'm Kedar Chirkent. Environmental advocates push for Enbridge's Line 5 pipeline to be shut down over concerns that an oil spill in the Straits of Mackinac would be disastrous to the environment. We get reaction as Michigan regulators approve a permit for a tunnel under the Great Lakes. Beth Wallace is here, Great Lakes Freshwater Campaign's manager at the National Wildlife Federation. Christopher Clark is a senior attorney with Earth Justice. Call in with a question. Share your perspective at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Christopher, does the Bay Mills Indian community plan to appeal the decision by the Michigan regulators in approving Enbridge's tunnel project?
The Michigan Public Service Commission issued its decision last Friday, and we are taking a look, a very close look at that decision to determine our next steps. It's a lengthy decision based on two different hearings in which a significant amount of evidence was offered, but we are certainly looking at our next steps to stop this tunnel.
We're going to bring in the voice here of Whitney Gravel, president of the Bay Mills Indian community. And this is Whitney in a 2022 interview with Earth Justice during a protest against Line 5, and Whitney saying that the Great Lakes are sacred to her tribe, worrying about the effects of a potential oil spill.
The Great Lakes for the Anishinaabe people is something sacred because you're tying in what water means to Anishinaabe people. At the beginning of creation, there is water. And so we need water in order to be able to continue to survive. And that is woven and interwoven throughout our teachings on how water gives life, water creates life, and then water takes life, because we return in that circle of life on that medicine wheel and are supposed to live in harmony with those natural resources.
Beth, what comes up for you when you hear Whitney Gravel talking about water is life?
This is absolutely true, and this is at the heart of what the Attorney General is fighting for in the state of Michigan in her legal case against Enbridge. So just to remind people, they are actively operating Line 5 illegally in two locations. In the Straits of Mackinac, they do not have an easement to operate the current pipelines, and on the Bad River Band, they've been trespassing since 2013. And so it's at the heart of the Attorney General's case is upholding citizens' rights to protect our land and water, our drinking water, our spaces that we hold in public trust. And Enbridge's legal fight against that really tries to upend all of those rights, not just for the state of Michigan, but for states across the country. And their legal attacks on the Bad River Band are similar. They are trying to dismantle sovereignty, their rights to land and water, so that they can earn the right to operate this 70-year-old pipeline until failure. And the proposal to reroute the pipeline or to put in this tunnel, all it is doing is extending the life of a 600-mile pipeline that has already leaked 35 times over 1 million gallons into the environment. It is not protecting our resources, and in fact, it's dismantling core rights that we all should be concerned about across the country.
Christopher, what treaty rights does the tribe say would be violated with construction of the tunnel under Straits of Mackinac?
So the tribes do, the Bay Mills and the other federally recognized tribes do have a treaty with the United States that protects their right to hunt, fish, and gather and conduct cultural traditions in the land and water in and around the Straits of Mackinac. So certainly an oil spill in the Straits of Mackinac would be devastating to the tribes, devastating economically. So for example, over half of Bay Mills households derive all or a portion of their household income from commercial fishing. If you destroy the water, you destroy people's ability to provide for themselves. But it is also, as indicated by President Gravel's comments that she played, this is an area of very deep spiritual and cultural significance for the tribes. In fact, it is, according to the traditions of the tribes, the center of creation. And so this is not a place to be running this kind of dangerous pipeline. And it really needs to be shut down.
I wonder, too, what are the engineering risks, boring through rock far below the Great Lakes lake bed to create this tunnel system? Would there be risks in that to worker safety and in maintenance, Christopher?
There are very significant risks. And Enbridge is falsely claiming that this tunnel would be a solution to the threat presented by the pipeline, and it is a false solution. We presented testimony and evidence from experts, a pipeline safety expert who's deeply concerned with the design of the tunnel. And the concern is that there would be a leak of petroleum products or natural gas liquids within this concrete tunnel. And when there's a leak like that, the liquid vaporizes, creating a highly flammable environment in a contained space. And that presents a significant risk of a fire and an explosion. So in essence, what Enbridge is doing is trying to replace one set of risks in the Straits of Mackinac with another, when in fact, what we should be doing is moving to clean energy sources and stop. This is just not the time for us to be investing in additional fossil fuel infrastructure that is simply going to prop up this aging pipeline so that a Canadian company can continue to generate profits. It's got to stop.
Christopher Clark with us, senior attorney at Earth Justice. Beth Wallace, Great Lakes campaigns manager for the National Wildlife Federation. You can join in questions and comments, 800-642-1234. Kyle in Ashland is here. Kyle, hi.
Hi, can you hear me?
We sure can. Go ahead.
Hi, I'm just calling to say thank you so much to your guests for getting this important news out to people. I live in Ashland, where Line 5 runs just south of town here, and I grew up in Michigan, where the line cut through my back rural lot of where I live. So my whole life has been kind of around this line, and I've seen it from, you know, where it ends in Sarnia, and one of the largest petrochemical refineries there, and some of the effects on First Nations communities there, to here in Ashland. And what I'm curious about right now is I am noticing just a profound bombardment of advertising and disinformation, I would term it, by Enbridge here in my community in Ashland and in this area. And I'm wondering, you know, so I'm grateful for actually getting more fact-based information out there. And I'm wondering if there's other suggestions from the callers for everyday people to kind of combat what is just an overwhelming amount of advertising and disingenuous advertising, I would say.
Beth Wallace, can you jump in here?
Yeah, I really appreciate this comment. And it really is why the tunnel is even a discussion point, is this misinformation. Enbridge and Canada in particular are basing all of their positioning right now on this false claim that Line 5 is critical infrastructure. They've presented this image that we have to have this pipeline, when we now have three, and including Enbridge's expert, four experts that have said you can easily transition within a matter of months with no impact whatsoever away from Line 5, and there's existing infrastructure. So I just want to say that out loud, because it is a major problem, and we've been tracking in Michigan mostly, but across the region, Enbridge has spent tens of millions of dollars during election cycles and during key decision points, including tribal elections, where they're spending a ton of money spreading this misinformation about the need of the pipeline. And it really is the only leg they have to stand on. And so that's the challenge that we have as public, and I'd say even businesses and scientists and academics are at this table of, like, how do we break through the ability for big corporations like this to basically write a narrative and spend the money to convince people of that narrative.
In our final moments together, Christopher Clark, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers still has to give its sign-off. What does that step entail, very briefly?
The Army Corps is going to be preparing an environmental impact statement of this proposed tunnel project, and that essentially is a determination as to the environmental impacts, and Bay Mills is actively involved in that process to inform the Army Corps about the dangers of this pipeline and the dangers of this proposed tunnel project. So that is ongoing. The fight against Line 5 continues, and we're hopeful that the Army Corps will reject Enbridge's application.
Thank you both for joining us. Christopher Clark there, senior attorney with Earth Justice. Beth Wallace is Great Lakes Freshwater Campaign's manager for the National Wildlife Federation. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We explore new findings in a long-term study of over 10,000 people who graduated from Wisconsin high schools in 1957 and what their lives are like now as octogenarians. But first, of the 45 known recovery high schools in America, there is only one in Wisconsin. And now there's room for more thanks to a bill Governor Tony Evers signed yesterday. Margaret Faust visited the only high school in the state for students in recovery from a substance use disorder.
It's a Tuesday afternoon in November at Horizon High School in Madison, and 17-year-old Cassidy, a senior, is licking a lollipop in science class. The students are learning about the scientific method by asking a question that originated in an old TV commercial. How many licks does it take to get to the center of a Tootsie Pop? Cassidy makes a tally mark for each lick on the back of her worksheet.
I made it!
What was your number?
Okay.
She starts counting her tallies.
Nice.
There you go. I made it.
How many was it?
5, 10, 15, 20, 25, 30. 30. Wait. 35, 30. Can I? Yeah.
She loses count, so her table mate Alex helps her. It took Cassidy 203 licks. Towards the end of class, a school administrator reminds the students.
The other thing, you guys, if you have not taken your UA, your name's on the board, please do it.
UA stands for urinary analysis, aka a drug test. They're a standard part of the week at Horizon High School. It's the only school in the state designed specifically for high school students recovering from substance abuse disorders and mental health struggles. There are small staff-to-student ratios, twice-weekly group therapy sessions, and immediate attention to mental health crises. Cassidy smoked weed for the first time in fifth grade. By the time she started high school, she was getting high multiple times a day.
I did want to stop, but at the same time, I didn't.
WPR is not identifying her by her full name in order to protect her privacy. She started at Horizon in September. Before that, she says she was an aggressive and anxious person.
I just didn't think, like, no one cared. And I started coming here, they were telling me, like, they care. And then it's just, like, you're not alone when you go to a school like this.
Horizon is a private, nonprofit school that contracts with other schools in surrounding districts. Most of their funding comes from donations and grants. But school leaders say expenses are rising and donations haven't increased. The state budget that passed this year includes $500,000 to fund new and existing recovery schools in Wisconsin. Advocates say they hope the grants will help launch other recovery schools around the state. Madeline Brown is the school's therapist. She says recovery schools help students in ways that other schools and programs can't.
They see me every day. You know, we've made relationships together, so they know me. So they're going to be more likely to reach out if they're struggling. And that's definitely going to happen when someone's staying sober.
Horizon is a part of the Association of Recovery Schools. It supports communities trying to open schools like Horizon. Roger Oser is its chair. He says substance abuse is costly.
Dropping out of school, becoming court involved, medical costs to society. And, you know, God forbid, obviously, with the opiate-based addictions, it's, you know, higher mortality rates and overdoses.
According to a 2021 survey by the Wisconsin Department of Public Instruction, 26% of high school students currently drink alcohol. 14% currently use marijuana. More than half the students surveyed were anxious, and a third were depressed. Tracy Gall, the school's director, says she's heard rumblings that other recovery schools could open in Wisconsin. She says it's worth it.
I've had kids come through here crying, screaming, angry, you know, no relationship with parents, flunking all their classes, not going to school, no job. And they get sober, and all of a sudden, things fall into place.
On the day of the visit, Cassidy brought her pet squirrel, Ozzy, to school with her. Ozzy scampers up Cassidy's arm before perching on her shoulder to snack on some nuts and seeds. Cassidy found Ozzy injured in a park near her home and took care of the squirrel because no one else seemed to know it was hurting. She says she feels like her school did the same for her. Margaret Faust, Wisconsin Public Radio.
It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. For more than 60 years now, a UW-Madison study has closely followed the life course of thousands of Wisconsin high school graduates from the class of 1957. We explore new findings from the so-called Happy Days cohort, and you can be part of the discussion. Call in with a question, share comments, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Michal Engelman is a professor of sociology at UW-Madison, director of the Wisconsin Longitudinal Study. Michal, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thanks so much for having me, Kate.
This study of more than 10,000 Wisconsin graduates touts being one of the most extensive, one of the most successful studies ever conducted in the social sciences. Why does the study deserve this distinction?
Sure, that's a great question. So, you know, this is a fascinating study because, like you said, it's the longest one of its kind in the United States. So this the study started out as a survey of high school graduates. The state of Wisconsin in 1957 decided it wanted to know what its graduating seniors wanted to study and do when they grow up. And so they did this one-time survey. It was never intended to be a longitudinal study at the time.
An innocent question.
Yeah, exactly. Sort of, you know, asking people what they wanted to study, where they wanted to do. And they actually used results from that survey in order to design the University of Wisconsin system, now known as the University of Wisconsin. But it helped them figure out where to put different campuses and what kinds of programs to establish at the different campuses. And I think at the time, they thought it was done. And what happened after that is in the 60s, a sociology professor at UW-Madison realized that those surveys were still around, and he sent postcards to the homes of these graduates. Most of them had left home by then, but their parents received those postcards, and they wrote back. And they told him, his name was William Sewell. He later became the chair of the sociology department. And they told him kind of where their children were, and he followed up with them. And there were additional surveys with them in the 70s and then later on in the 90s and into the 2000s. And somehow it became a study that wasn't just about high school students, but really followed them across the life course, and has been able to look first at what kinds of jobs they had, what kind of families they built, what happens in their personal and volunteer life. And then as the cohort aged, the study aged with them and became about health, about retirement, and about family relationships and support and physical, mental, and cognitive health in later life.
Yeah, a true study of lifespan. You know, fast forward to researchers now, decades later, how do you determine what questions to ask people in the cohort?
Yeah, that's a really great question. So, you know, the study has evolved over the years, and there have been different people leading it. There have been some really great investigators at UW-Madison who have led the study at various times. I mentioned Bill Sewell, who is kind of the originator of the study. After him, Bob Hauser was the principal investigator of the study for over 30 years. And he was a scholar of education and inequality. He was really interested in how people's educational experience and trajectories impacted their occupational histories and impacted sort of both their own earnings and inequality in society at large. So the study really focused on that as as participants were going through their primary working years and building families. And then about 15 years ago, the study was directed by Pamela Hurd, who is a public policy scholar and really a scholar of health and aging as well. And as participants were entering retirement, she started collecting more systematic data on their physical health, on their mental health, collecting some biological data, as well as some of the social surveys that had been collected before. And over the past few years, as participants have been in their 80s, we have shifted to really thinking a lot about cognitive health, both risk and resilience, and talking to participants about their memory and their well-being. And one of the great advantages of a study this big is that we're able to look at factors both that impact kind of why people end up having negative health outcomes in later life, but also thinking a lot about what are the factors that help people remain healthy and resilient as they grow old as well.
In the area of health factors, the study revealed early detection methods for Alzheimer's disease. What do scientists know about Alzheimer's due to this study?
Oh, that's a great question. So in many ways, one of the things that's really unique about the Wisconsin Longitudinal Study is the fact that we've had measures on participants over many years. So, in 1957, the state of Wisconsin actually wanted a lot of high school students to take IQ tests. And then over the years, we've asked participants to take a few different tests to tell us about their memory and about their recall. And so we've been able to look at how some of their educational patterns and some of their early cognitive measures are influencing how they are doing now that we're collecting more intensive measures of memory. So we've been able to look at how people's, things as, for example, like what classes you took in high school or what kinds of extracurricular activities you were involved in, how that impacts cognition when folks are in their 60s and 70s and in their 80s. And then we're also able to compare information from healthy people in the Wisconsin longitudinal cohort, as well as people who are experiencing cognitive decline, to think about how to best analyze patient data to diagnose Alzheimer's disease. And this is great because it's not just researchers who are here at UW-Madison who are able to use the data for these purposes, but also folks kind of across the country and the world who are using the data.
That's what I noticed, is just that it seems like the data is very accessible to researchers of disciplines outside social sciences. Is that true?
Yeah, it is. One of the unique things about the study is we have been funded by the National Institutes of Health since 1991 continuously. So we take that very seriously because we're effectively funded by taxpayer dollars to collect this data. And so we think that it is our job to make these data available kind of for scientific discovery more broadly. So, we collect the data, we go through very rigorous processes of de-identifying it, right, to make sure that patients' information and participants' information remains private, and that no one can sort of figure out who's who in the data. But the information, once it's in its de-identified form, becomes publicly available to researchers who register to use the data and who abide by sort of important protections that the university has in place to make sure that research is conducted according with rules. But once we do that, we make it available to any researcher who registers with us. Mm-hmm. And so that means we've got sociologists, economists, people in public policy and psychology. But increasingly, as we've been collecting this great health data, we have folks from the medical sciences, from public health, thinking about it. And so we have been able to have people who look at physical function, people who look at a variety of particular chronic conditions, and increasingly, because we've been investing a lot recently in these cognitive measures, we have a lot of scholars in, from the world of trying to understand neuroscience and cognition in later life who have started to use the data.
UW-Madison sociology professor Michal Engelman directs the Wisconsin Longitudinal Study, considered one of America's longest studies in the social sciences. You can be part of the discussion. Call in with questions, comments. They're welcome at 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We explore findings from Wisconsin's Happy Days cohort, helping researchers better understand aging. For more than 65 years, thousands of graduates of Wisconsin high schools in 1957 periodically answer surveys about their lives, and the study group is now in their 80s. Call in with a question. Share your views. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Sociologist Michal Engelman directs the Wisconsin Longitudinal Study, leads the Center for Demography of Health and Aging at UW-Madison. Let's bring in Eugene in Viola. Eugene, hi. Go ahead.
Good morning. I come out of the class of 57 or 58. If I make it until January, I'll be 85. And most of us in that class, that were in that class, some of us went to college and some of us didn't, but we got good jobs, we bought homes, we raised families, and we came out of college without any debt. And I was still substitute teaching until I was 82.
Wow. Wow. Eugene, thank you so much for calling in. And I think Eugene brings up some contrasts to what it may be like today for graduates. Michal, go ahead.
Yeah, no, this is great to hear. I'm really glad Eugene called in. You know, one of the things that has been really interesting about studying this cohort is thinking about how unique their experience was, right? They were graduating from high school sort of during the Cold War, right? They were they benefited both from a lot of economic growth in the years following World War II and kind of seeing the strengthening American economy. And as Eugene said, right? Right. Many of them were able to kind of go through their life course, you know, kind of pursuing either more education or jobs that still had, you know, really great working conditions. And they were able to build families in a way that many people feel is changing nowadays. And one of the things we have tried to learn from the data is about the factors that made that possible for this cohort, right? What are some of the things, not just individual characteristics, but some of the policies that were in place, the community structures and support and investments, right, that made it possible for that cohort to succeed to the extent that it has, in order to learn about both, you know, why things might be different for cohorts that are going through life right now, but also thinking about what lessons we may draw from that for the types of investments in people and communities that we should be doing.
I wonder about diversifying the cohort and your efforts there, because the study is of mostly white participants with high school diplomas. What are you hoping to do with the study to reflect Wisconsin's diverse population?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, as you said, this study is very unique because it's population-based. So it's highly representative of people who graduated from high school in Wisconsin in 1957. But it is a mostly white sample, which is accurate because it's reflecting who graduated from high school back then. And so, you know, the people who have participated in the cohort for the past 65 years, they're irreplaceable, right? We can't go back in time and find additional people who can provide that richness and depth of data. And we know a lot about their life, but one of the things we've been trying to do lately is think about how their experiences compare to those of other folks who are aging in Wisconsin, but maybe are not in the Wisconsin Longitudinal Study. So one recent project that we've been doing is sort of an ancillary study to the WLS is a result of my collaboration with Professor Maichu Lohr at the University of Wisconsin School of Nursing. She is Hmong American, and a lot of her research has focused on the health and well-being of the Hmong community. And folks here in Wisconsin are probably familiar with that, but the Hmong are a refugee population from Laos that were resettled in the U.S. in the aftermath of the Vietnam War and the secret war in Laos. And the U.S. government resettled them in Wisconsin and Minnesota and California largely. And so they are the state's largest Asian American population. And we have started a project trying to understand how their experience, which in many ways is so different from that of the original Wisconsin longitudinal study, how that compares. And we're really interested in thinking about, well, what's similar for all people who are growing old in Wisconsin together, but also what are the ways in which people's experiences earlier in the life course, right? What does it mean if you've been through war and stints in refugee camps and persecution and migration and building a new life in a completely new place with a new language and a new environment? How does that impact your health and well-being in later life? And so by doing interviews and life histories with the Hmong population, we're hoping to learn about that and also to eventually do a small survey with this population as well, where some of the questions will be harmonized, we say, or very similar to what we've asked our long-term WLS participants, and will allow us to compare their health and well-being with the folks with the Hmong population as well.
We're exploring a decades-long study with UW-Madison sociologist Michal Engelman. You can join in. Questions 800-642-1234. I'm curious, what does it feel like for you as a researcher, as you see your study participants getting up in age? Is there more of an urgency at this point with this cohort, with these participants?
Yeah, you know, there is. I have to say, you know, we are... We recognize that we are dealing with a precious population, right? We've always felt that they are, you know, really, really special. And it's been really an honor to have people be willing to participate in a study for 65 years. There are not any other studies in the United States who can say the same. And so we feel like people have really committed to our study. And as a result, we're committed back to them. But we also recognize that, you know, like any good thing, it can't last forever. We're happy to report that people in the WLS are doing well. As of a year ago, of last December, when our data kind of are most recent from, over 57% of the original cohort was still with us, right? Mm-hmm. But we are starting to lose folks. The fact that people are living longer and healthier than maybe other folks who were born around the same time, if we compare it to people who were born in 1939, 1940, in the general U.S. population, it's closer to 40% who are still around, and we have more than that. And so we appreciate that they enjoy greater longevity and health, and we're trying to learn why that is. But we also recognize that won't last forever, and we want to make the most of the time that we have with them.
Michal, thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Michal Engelman is a sociology professor and director of the Wisconsin Longitudinal Study at UW-Madison. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.